Greetings, everyone. Happy birthday, America. I think it was really appropriate, the two songs we sang, and I think a lot of you were probably a little surprised and your memory refreshed by singing the second verse of the Star-Spangled Banner. I doubt if one American out of a million has that verse memorized. And I hope the Supreme Court doesn't find out we just sang it. Oh, thus be it ever, when free men shall stand between their loved homes and the war's desolation, blessed with victory and peace, may the heaven-rescued land praise the power that hath made and preserved us a nation. You can't get away with saying that in school classroom these days. Then conquer we must when our cause it is just, and this be our motto, in God is our trust. And the Star-Spangled Banner in triumph shall wave over the land of the free and the home of the brave. How did we get that way? When I grew up as a young man in Eugene, Oregon, entering my teens during those war years when America was involved in a life and death struggle against the embodiment of all evil, the Axis powers, who in their many millions sought to enslave us and in fact enslave the entirety of the world, I didn't have the faintest idea on many occasions during that conflict just by how slim a thread we eked out a marginal victory. Just how desperate the situation truly was in those first years, 1941, 42, and early 43. But eventually, as we won the victory, and I remember cutting school on VE Day and getting in our state truck and a bunch of us going down Eugene up and down the main street and shouting and screaming and really being excited because victory in Europe had come, and finally VJ Day and victory over Japan had then come along. I remember so vividly those days because I was merely 15 at war's end. I forget the exact time in which I'm about to relate something that occurred to me, but I remember a young Marine had come home from the 1st Marine Division wearing dress Marine Corps uniform with that proud badge, one with Guadalcanal written in it, walked down the aisle at a little clapboard church in Eugene, Oregon, outside the corporate limits, with my sister Dottie on his arm, my father up there to perform that ceremony. I don't know of a time when I've ever been so proud when I saw my sister marry a Marine. Because he'd been over there in the jungles of Guadalcanal as an artillery spotter with the Marine Corps, and along the way had contracted malaria and had an awful lot of experience. When you're lying there in a little foxhole you dug with your own shovel and several Japanese battleships and cruisers are lobbing 16-inch shells ashore and they're blowing up trees and bivouacs and areas all around you, it's a very frightening occasion. He was there cowering in that foxhole with a lot of other people the night all five Sullivans died aboard the USS Astoria, and Iron Bottom Bay earned its name. I don't want to embarrass my brother-in-law, Vern Matson, but he's here with us today, and my sister, Dottie, and they've come all the way from Bend, Oregon, and drove all the way over here. Took them over 3 days, I think 3.5 days. They're going to be staying with us for a good little while. He's in the back row back there. Vern, do you mind if I introduce you to the audience? He used to be the business manager of Ambassador College in the early days of the college for about the first 15 years. And Dottie, my sister Dottie, she is the other surviving sibling of the Armstrong family now, just Dottie and I, of the other two children, my brother Dick and sister Beverly, who died earlier this year. That was a great loss to us. I don't think there has ever been a time in my life that I was quite so prideful as the moment that I was called up to the flight deck when I'd been aboard the USS Antietam, an aircraft carrier, Essex class, 888 feet long, 3,000 men aboard, and 5 squadrons of aircraft, including the old F-4U, bought Sikorsky Corsair and the F-9F Panther jets. And the captain said, "We have just joined elements of the 7th Fleet. As you can, getting away from your duties, we would like all of you to come up on deck and take a look." And I walked up and looked, and right over there was the battleship Iowa. And over there was the battleship Wisconsin. And a little further on was the Bonhomme Richard, another aircraft carrier like the one I was on. And altogether, there were two battleships, three aircraft carriers, about five or six heavy cruisers, and about 13 light cruisers, and about 23 destroyers. And they extended in all directions so far over the horizon you couldn't even see that entire 7th Fleet of the United States. But I don't think I've ever been quite so prideful as I was at that moment to be a part of that extension of American power offshore Korea. I didn't have the faintest idea then of the geopolitical consequences of the Korean battle, and how futile was the loss of that life, and how our politicians decided to commit troops piecemeal into battle for the purpose of bringing an enemy to the conference table and not for the purpose of seizing and holding territory or for the purpose of depriving an enemy of the will to fight, of knocking out his industrial base or denying him sanctuary. That was all to come much, much later. How well I remember during those war years of World War II and even during the Korean War, the outpouring of patriotism that we in the United States experienced. As a young lad, when I would go to the movies after collecting bottles along the roadways in Eugene, Oregon, and got my 11 cents in my little hand, went downtown to go to the movie, if they flashed a picture of FDR, which they always did on the screen, the entire theater came to their feet and applauded and really let out a spontaneous amount of patriotism and pride about the country. Same thing for Winston Churchill. And they would always begin and conclude the movies with the Star Spangled Banner. Today it is not that way in our country, is it? You don't see pride in the country. You have a situation where in one of our big cities, in a kind of a copycat riot, we had all kinds of people destroying automobiles and burning and looting and savagely beating people and rioting in the streets because the basketball team won a game. Can you imagine what they might have done to the city of Chicago if they'd lost? It's incomprehensible, the things that are happening to our country these days. And I think it's time that we looked at it in perspective and talked about it and became a little more thankful than perhaps we are prone to be year in and year out, of living in a United States of America that had a different meaning when they forged the document called the Declaration of Independence, because the word United States emphasized states. When I say today the United States of America, we think of a big federal government, and we think of one giant entity with the headquarters in Washington, D.C. That was not the way the Founding Fathers envisioned it, and they always talked about these united, collective, many, many states. And when you said states, you thought of Oregon, Ohio, and Texas, and so on. Of course, them, in their case, the original 13 colonies that were declared to be states. Villagers, just because of their religious and their political differences with the Shia and the Sunni Muslims in that country. My daughter-in-law is here today, too. She comes from parents who are Serb Croat. And over there today in Yugoslavia, we've just seen the first little bit of good news in the last couple of days with the C-130s getting into the airport at Sarajevo to begin to take medicine and food into people who are predominantly Muslim. Because the other people, the Serbs, don't like the idea that the Bosnia-Herzegovina area would have wanted to set up an Islamic government. And you know their near neighbor is Albania with the capital Tirana, and they are Muslim, Islamic, and because of that, you have religious struggles going on, and people over there are killing one another. Do you ever get thankful thinking about the fact that that cannot happen in the United States of America? That there is no such thing as a private militia in this nation. There is no such thing as a state army. Oh, there's the National Guard, under central national control and under the governor of that state for an emergency, but so far as Baptists starting to shoot into a Catholic city, or Catholics attacking Baptists, or even the Islamic people among us, or people of all sorts of different religious persuasions, the people of the Baha'i faith, people of some of the East Asian religions, and you see them walking in the saris and the funny garb down the streets of Los Angeles with white robes on and the women with a diamond and a pierced nose. And they have a right to be here. And they have a right to exercise that religion. And no one can interfere with that. Robert Tilton or Hilton or whatever his name is has a right to get on television and bilk people out of millions of dollars. And if he didn't have that right, I wouldn't have the right to get on television and tell people the truth. So freedom is a two-edged sword, and sometimes we don't like the way it cuts in the negative because it allows other people to have rights with which sometimes we disagree. Back during those days, when I grew up as a young teenage, those rights were still there, and they were precious, and they were exercised. But they were exercised responsibly. I do not remember back during those days that we had anywhere near the assault on the American family, on the American educational system, on religion by the Supreme Court itself denying prayers. As a matter of fact, we commonly had a Bible teacher who came for only one class per week in the Eugene public school systems to teach us the Bible and to have us memorize verses out of the Bible back in 1936, 7, 8, 9, 40, 41, etc. And we believed in that second verse of the national anthem. We believed in the motto of our flag. We believed in what we printed on our dollar bills, "In God We Trust." And we weren't ashamed of it. But who here does not remember Tiananmen Square, the Chinese students crushed beneath the treads of tanks? You and I could get into a 747 and within hours be in another nation where the freedoms and the privileges and the liberties that we just take for granted are absolutely denied those people. They don't have them. They cannot do as my sister and brother-in-law just did, get in their automobile and go across who knows how many states, Oregon, Idaho, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and never meet some border guard, never have to give them documents, don't have to change their money into a different kind of money. They don't have to have their trunk and their baggage searched. They don't have to walk through metal detectors. And if they'd wanted to, they could have bought property in every state they went through. You got to be able to afford that, but, you know, you can do it. We take it so much for granted. You and I are people who perhaps are very different from the average American because of our belief in God, in God's Word, in the prophecies of the Bible, and in the very grave jeopardy in which the United States finds itself because of our understanding of the identity of our peoples, the history of the development of all of the democracies of Northwestern Europe, of England, and eventually the colonization of the United States and Canada, and all the other colonies of the British Empire, which have become very large, in most cases, sovereign nations in their own right. But South Africa, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and so on. Most of us probably know very little about the Magna Carta. I picked my 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica off the shelf and reread the article to refresh my memory once again this morning about how the barons of England began to gang up on King John, who was loyal to the Pope in Rome, and that this was as much a religious exercise in trying to cause a British king to relinquish his ties with the papacy at Rome and to declare that the British church was sovereign as it was an argument about money and about tyranny, although all of those declarations were there as well. There were some 63 articles or chapters in the Magna Carta that was signed at Runnymede in about the 12th century by King John when the barons revolted against him and refused to pay the scutage, as they called it, or the taxes that he was imposing upon them. The Magna Carta, once it came into being, guaranteed by law a system of courts, freedom from arbitrary activity of a despotic government, and it forced King John to concede to all of the demands, of which there were dozens, and the most important was in chapter 39 that stated no free man could any further be arrested summarily, imprisoned, deprived of his property, exiled, or in any way destroyed except by legal judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. But prior to the signing of that document, the king had that kind of power. And his sheriffs could go out, and if someone refused to pay an exorbitant tax, they could simply grab the guy, put him in the dungeon, put him to death, take his property away from him. There was no trial. There were no peers to hear the pros and cons. There was no system that we might call the judiciary in that nation at all. The Magna Carta limited, under the threat of war, and there were wars all the way from Normandy, all over the north of England, until John was forced to back down, or else himself be killed and exiled. There were wars that resulted in limiting drastically the absolute monarchy of Great Britain, wherein despotic, sensuous, lustful, and some of that language was there as well, spoiled princes could destroy and rape and loot and pillage with no constraints whatsoever. Actually, King John either murdered or procured the murder of his own nephew, Arthur, the Duke of Brittany. When the wife of a baron made an indiscreet reference to the crime, John heard about it, crushed her family's power, drove her husband and one son into exile out of England, starved the baroness and her eldest son to death in a dungeon. That was the kind of man he was. Now, the Magna Carta was not as important a document at the time it was signed as later revisionists and historians claimed that it was. But over the many, many years, there were actually reconfirmations forced upon monarchs of England through various political power. 44 separate times, they had to grab those monarchs and bring them by the power of the people back to that Magna Carta, make them look at it again, and make them sign a document that reconfirmed it. And there were historians who wrote about it. Among them was Sir Edward Coke, 1552 to 1634, who wrote a treatise on the Magna Carta. And all that means is the Grand or the Great Charter. And it shaped the thinking of a young man in the colonies of this country named Thomas Jefferson. And so one of the architects of our freedom had the concept of the kind of government that had been set down by the barons of London way back so long ago, June 15, 1215, about human dignity, civil rights, and it shaped the thought process, the thinking of Thomas Jefferson. So the American concept of freedom dates all the way back to the Magna Carta. I'd like to refresh your memory, if I may, pretend I'm in a school classroom for a moment, take time out and read something to you that you probably have not read for so many years, if you ever read it all, and you may not remember, even from high school, some of these words you're about to hear. In Congress, July 4, 1776, a declaration by the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth a separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. It took this country generations of strife and a civil war and the civil rights movement, and they have still not swallowed that bitter pill that those divinely inspired founding fathers understood. However, as an apologetic, some of the men assembled in that Congress were themselves slave owners. That they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they're accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpation pursuing invariably the same object evidences a design to reduce them under the absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Then follows a very lengthy charge against King George. He has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He's forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance. I'll just read an abbreviated version of it. He's refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records for the purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly. He's refused for a long time after such dissolution to cause others to be reelected. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for that purpose, obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriation of lands. He's obstructed the administration of justice. He's made judges dependent on his will alone. He's erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures, and on it goes, the grievances. And eventually, as a result of all of that, nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We've appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we've conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They too have been deaf to the voice of justice and of consanguinity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends. We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intention. Interesting language. Do in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that our political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of the divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Then is a list of the signatories: John Adams, Samuel Adams, Josiah Bartlett, Carter Braxton, Charles Carroll of Carrollton, Maryland, named after his family. Most of them you won't remember. Merchants, lawyers, soldiers, a printer and publisher, a physician, two farmers, a merchant, another farmer, a lawyer, a judge, a lawyer, two more farmers, two merchants and a farmer, Thomas Lynch. So many farmers, so many judges, physicians, merchants, clergymen, and a few lawyers among them. Witherspoon, Wilson, Whipple, Walton, Thornton, those are not familiar names. But if you were to go back during that time, living in those colonies, knowing you are incurring the wrath of the mightiest nation on the face of the earth, the vast British Empire, with her hundreds upon hundreds of armed ships, with her tens of thousands of armed men, with her armies standing among you, with her forts and her officers and her red-coated armed soldiers all about you, can you begin to imagine what they were laying on the line? Their lives. I remember one time a group of dissidents with whom I had to deal personally at Ambassador College many, many years ago. And their attitude was so almost supercilious about the exercise of their privileged liberties and their freedoms. And because they wanted to do something which was patently wrong and contrary to the principles of Ambassador College, to the laws and rules by which we regulated that institution, I gave a sermon one day in which I talked about these documents, about the freedom of the United States of America, and who won it and why. And I reminded them of the first time I ever went to Anzio in Italy, with the cameras there and with my tape recorder, and walked out among acre after acre after acre of white crosses and stars of David, and read all of these names of the men who stormed ashore at Anzio and were caught in a trap between a couple of heavy armored German divisions, and so many of them died on that beach and fighting for that city. I'd also been at the large military cemetery in Luxembourg where General George Patton was buried, and several other large American military cemeteries overseas. There's a huge one near Manila in the Philippines. And I talked about the large number of people who had died in the wars of this country, especially in World War I and World War II. And at the end of my remarks, I congratulated these students for exercising their freedom and their liberty. And I told them they had a right to do so. But I said it would be very nice indeed if the next time you attempt to exercise that right, you do it with just a little more humility, recognizing the price that was paid to give it to you. Now, who made you free? Who gave you your freedom? I did not have to earn mine. As I was a little child growing up in grade school and began to learn where I was, I didn't know where I was. Oregon was Oregon, and little by little they taught me about a country called the United States of America. And when I was a child growing up, they forced me to do something that was kind of tough. A lot of people have forgotten all of that today, I think, but we had to memorize the capitals of every state. And at that time, we were only the contiguous 48, so we didn't have to bother with Alaska and Hawaii. But we knew them very, very well. Quick, what's the capital of Vermont? See what I mean? I guess the French pronounced it Montpellier, didn't they? But it's Montpelier. But we not only had to learn a great deal about the geography of our nation, about its mineral resources, about its national parks, about its railways, the demographics, the population distribution, the ancient peoples who lived here, the 13 colonies, the Louisiana Purchase, the history of the settlement of the West, the Oregon Trail, the Bozeman Trail, the first great cattle drives up to Kansas from Texas. We also had to learn a very great deal about our state history, about Dr. McLaughlin, and about the Indians among whom some of the early missionaries came, and about Lewis and Clark and how they opened up the trail to the West, and the fights with the Russians down in San Francisco that had an enclave in California, and the fights with the Mexicans that had all of the southern states that are called by Spanish names, Colorado, that means colored, Nevada, that means snowy, and Nuevo Mexico or New Mexico, etc., Arizona, which merely means arid zone, which it certainly is. And we learned about all these things, the history of our nation. And they instilled in us, growing up in Oregon back in the 30s and 40s, a sense of pride, a sense of belonging, a sense of kinship, one nation under God. And I guess that's why I today am such an ultra-rightist when it comes to people who are tracking mud all over my carpet, who are wrecking my furniture, who are destroying my bric-a-brac, who are tearing up my family album, who are abusing, destroying my bathroom, because I live here, and this is my country. And when I see people rioting and burning the cities down, and when I see people, let me give you an analogy right quickly about music. When I see some of these long-haired heavy metal creeps on MTV doing their thing, I'm reminded of how when we go to Mexico and the mariachis come by in the restaurant, we say, "Play Mexico Lindo for me, will you please?" And they do. How about playing Guadalajara? And they do. How about playing Cucurucurú la Paloma, and they do. Songs that date back 60, 70, and 80 years and longer. 100 years and more. Who wants to hear them? Americans. So, when people come to this country, play for me. Home on the Range. No way. Never heard of it. The kids in school today never heard of it. They've never heard of Red River Valley. They've never heard of some of the songs we used to gather around in an evening and sing in our backyards over a watermelon on the 4th of July. They've never heard some of the fine old songs because it was a part of our culture. And the idea seems to be in the United States today, if it is culture, destroy it. Away with culture. We got our own creepy, weird, heavy metal, long-haired, drug-crazed culture. Let's destroy everything that has value and history and tradition. Let's spit on it, and worse than that, let's just destroy it. Do away with it totally. When President Eisenhower put his hand on the Bible and was sworn in as President of the United States, he said in his State of the Union message shortly thereafter, and I quote, "America did not become great through softness and self-indulgence. Her miraculous progress and achievement flow from other qualities far more worthy and substantial. Adherence to principles and methods consonant with our religious philosophy. A satisfaction in hard work. The readiness to sacrifice for worthwhile causes. The courage to meet every challenge to her progress. The intellectual honesty and capacity to recognize the true path of her own best interest." But you know, it seems in retrospect, almost prophetic, that only a few days previous to that outstanding speech, Robert Babson said, and I quote, "The test of a nation is the growth of its people physically, intellectually, and spiritually. Money and so-called prosperity are of very little account. Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, Spain, and France all have their turn in being the richest in the world. Instead of saving them, in each case, their so-called prosperity ruined them. Our nation is now rated the richest, but it could easily become a second-class nation and head downward. Money will not save us. Crops will not save us. Stock exchanges and banks will not save us. Already our gold at Fort Knox is diminishing." Was he ever out of date? It's long since gone, and of course we owe far more than we ever possessed. Only a sane spiritual revival which changes the desires of our people will save us. We must be filled with a desire to render service, to seek strength rather than security, to put character ahead of profits. Even the democracy for which our fathers fought and bled could result in our downfall. Now, at the moment, the Japanese Prime Minister is in Washington and being interviewed by some of the major news media and doing a little bit of aw shucks apology for having been allegedly misquoted when he said that he doubted a very great deal the American work ethic and compared the difference between our working class people and the working class people in the United States, because he was merely opining that the average American is out for the quick buck. Well, the average Japanese is willing to invest 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, a lifetime, and has a tremendous amount of loyalty to his company and loyalty to his nation. There are no blonde Japanese, are there? You see, the Japanese are one race of people with a completely different religion from ours, a completely different language written and spoken from ours, a completely different history, and they happen to be a very intelligent race of people, and they are people who are willing to sacrifice for the long haul where Americans are not. I cite one example, there are several, of this high-resolution TV that is coming out in flat screens now that is beginning to be marketed in the United States. Our research and development people actually broke through the technology to produce that, but decided it was way too expensive because the commitment, the capital up front, and the years of research and development that it would take to actually bring it to the marketplace was simply going to be too costly, and they decided to abandon the project. The Japanese did not, and they continued with it, and it's going to revolutionize home television viewing. On a per capita basis, the Japanese have far more telephones, transistors, cellular telephones, and far more of the dishwashers and the various 90-some energy slaves the American housewife enjoys than we do on a per capita basis. Now today, Europeans work less and are paid more. They have longer paid vacations. Today, the United States is no longer the richest nation in the world. We are the biggest debtor nation in the world, and those nations are our creditors. We owe Japan 1 month's sweat, blood, and work by the entire United States labor force every year just to pay the interest we owe Japan on our national debt. Yet these words spoken by Babson back in the Eisenhower administration that talked about how we might become a second-class nation and head downward seem to be occurring to us right now today. The United States of America, if we don't stop that trend, could become like another Bangladesh. We could become third, fourth-rate nation, a have-not nation, a third-world nation, where our prosperity will have simply gone. 2 weeks before Babson said that, George Kennan, well-known American historian, said before a Washington audience, "If you ask me as an historian whether a country and the state in which this country finds itself today," and that was in 1960, 32 long years ago, "with no highly developed sense of national purpose, with the overwhelming accent of life on personal comfort and amusement, with a dearth of public services, and a surfeit," meaning surfeited, meaning bloated, overabundant, "privately sold gadgetry, with a chaotic transportation system, with insufficient social discipline even to keep its major industries functioning without grievous strikes and disruption, then our nation is surely headed in the wrong direction, and if we do not change it, it may be too late for the United States of America." I could read to you a lot of scriptures about where our nation is today, but I think I'll simply go to an analogy in the first chapter of the book of Isaiah. And this is the only scripture I will read today. If we were to take Uncle Sam, and we were to say that he is the embodiment of the nation, but he is a good old uncle of ours, and he is actually a little ill, not feeling too perky these days, and we take him in for an opinion, a doctor, for a complete physical checkup, and we ask, what is wrong with old Uncle Sam? He's got kind of arrhythmia. His liver's not really purging his bloodstream the way it ought to. He's in danger of kidney failure. He's got poor circulation. He's got hardening of the arteries. Brain isn't working too good. He's got aches and pains in all of his joints. His eyesight's going. His hearing's not too good. He's got some skin infections. He's got some intestinal problems. Most of his vital organs need transplant, and we're running out of baboons. You know, we're running out of baboons to transplant them. People were marching with the signs, you know, "Did the baboon give his consent?" We're all concerned about baboons. Well, if we put him there on the doctor's table and the doctor gets out his thermometer and takes the blood pressure and begins to look all over the body, what is he going to find? It says, beginning in verse 2, and this is a message to really all the nations, "Hear, O heavens, and give earth, O ear, for the Eternal has spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knows his owner, and the ass his master's crib, but Israel does not know, my people does not consider. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors, they have forsaken the Eternal, they have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger, they are gone away backward. Why should you be stricken any more? You will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick, and the whole heart faint. From the sole of the foot to the top of the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment." And we're talking here of spiritual dressings, we're talking of spiritual analyses, and we're talking of spiritual cures. Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, strangers devour it in your presence, and it is desolate as overthrown by strangers. When I look at all the things with which I've taken issue in this past year, at the riots in Los Angeles and the litany of wrong from the man that was greedy who wanted to sell the videotape to the media who wanted to repeat it and repeat it and repeat it 147 times until they virtually caused a race war in the United States, the policeman who brutally beat a man after he was down and helpless, the litany of wrong. Everybody was wrong. Rodney King was wrong. The police were wrong. The man that took the video was wrong. The media was wrong. The jury was wrong. And the rioters were wrong. And I did a television program on that. And you won't believe my hate mail. Before I even got, I said at the beginning of the program, now wait, put some of your passions on the shelf because I'll get to it in due time, but I'm going to go through this systematically. Now, Rodney King was wrong. Click. Dial 903-561-2525. I'll never watch that blankety blank program again. And that's the way some of them were. They wouldn't even listen. I got some mail that came from people that don't like me very well. And then I got a lot of calls and I got a lot of mail from people that did kind of like what I said, that were applauding what I said and agreed with it. The other day, I watched a Channel 8 interview with a man who was a member of three people on a parole board in Fort Worth, Texas, that recently paroled a filthy, rotten murderer. And decided that this man could become a good citizen. Well, they went into some detail and they found that apparently the prosecuting attorney, the attorney for the defense, was a personal friend of the man who was a judge, a retired judge, who was now on the parole board. So a few months earlier, when he learned that and learned who this individual was, who had now come up for parole, who originally was sentenced to die down in Huntsville in the electric chair. But that was back before the Supreme Court kicked out the death penalty. So the man's sentence was commuted to life, and he was sitting down in Huntsville. Now it was time for, according to the law, every so many years, he behaved himself, making license plates and watching TV and lifting weights and becoming a scuba diver on our tax money. And he behaved himself during all that time. In the prison library and studying to be a lawyer and whatever else he was doing, having free access to books that cost you money, but he gets them free. So, when the man on the parole board, the retired judge, found out that this was a personal friend of his that had tried to actually defend the man, he said, I hereby withdraw, and I will not be a part of that parole board. Well, there came another vote about a month later, and this time he did vote, and he proved to be the swing vote, 2-1, and let the man out on the street. And almost immediately he started killing women. How many did he murder? Was it 6 more? I forget. But it showed the other day them manacling this man and leading him back to prison again. And they say, as they weep and go up and down out the courthouse steps with their hair shirts and pounding their breasts and saying, oh, it's absolutely wrong to murder. Don't you murder that serial killer that murdered about 14 women. It's wrong to kill. You're descending to his level. Besides, says the sign, it does not deter crime. It doesn't? You mean if you put him to death, he's still going to kill people from the grave? Seems to me like it deters crime. He's not going to kill anybody else anymore. But you can look at anything you want to look at. We can take the nation apart and we can look at its brain. If you want to talk about the intelligentsia of the nation, what do you think about the think tanks, the brain trust? What do you think about our educators? What do you think about our educational system, and what do you think about our politicians? What do you think about Congress? What do you think about the likes of, well, shall I mention the entire number of the ones who were kicked out during the Reagan years, the so-called sleaze factor? If you go back to the resignation of Richard Nixon, you go back to the resignation of Spiro Agnew, you can say that corruption, abuse of power, usurpation of power, and, of course, some of the very same things of whom the barons of London accused King John were happening in the White House during the Nixon years, that it goes, as the Bible says, to the head and to the sole of the foot. If the circulatory system is our nation's highways and trucks and railways, what about the other day? How many billions did it cost us? Because one small handful of people, did you see them standing out there? Weren't they classic cases of an American workman? Most of them could have wheeled that belly around in a wheelbarrow. Standing there with about 4 days of beard on their face, looked like they'd been drug in from the green swamp. And the one little group in one particular union struck, and because that caused a blockage at a particularly strategic part of the rail system, it was like a domino effect, and the whole nation's rail shut down for a few days, and Congress was reluctant to step in, and we all heard about all of that, and billions of dollars were lost, and it actually could have shut down the entire automotive industry. It could have shut down all kinds of major industries that depend on a regular flow of those goods, of those materials, and those fabricated commodities that, with which they make automobiles. Well, we know about all of that. But if you look at the United States bit by bit and piece by piece, at the infrastructure, at our big cities, at crime, at education, at health and welfare, at insider trading, at the guys like Lincoln Savings and Keating, who stole so many billions of dollars that he impoverished tens of thousands of Americans, some of whom also fought in World War II and long ago retired and are middle-aged and elderly and living on a fixed income, whose savings were utterly wiped out by men with such an egotistical, swelling, unbelievable amount of greed that they just had to have their parties and their yachts and their trips out to the coast and down to the Caribbean and giving and handing out to people all these political favors. And of course, we all know the story. We've been following it in the news. Is this analogy correct? Is it really true that the United States is a sick country in many ways? When I think of America the Beautiful, I think of our national park. I think of Kansas cornfields. I think of Crater Lake and the mountains of Oregon. I think of my beloved Colorado and the places where I go hunting, the snow-capped Rockies. I think about Big Bend National Park and the vastness that is Texas, 2.5 days' drive and you're still in the state. You see, when I think of America the Beautiful, my America, my home, my country, I have to go back and think about its vast natural resources. I have to think about its unique weather pattern. Did you know it's unique? Have you ever studied it? Do you know it is utterly unique as compared with any other part of the world? Do you know that unless that so-called Japanese current, that warm current, were coming down the way it does at Alaska and Washington and Oregon, would virtually be uninhabitable compared to the way it is today? Do you have any idea about our soil in Iowa? Do you know the topsoil in Iowa? Do you know how deep it is? Let me tell you first of all that the average topsoil, that is the humus on the top of soil all over the world, averages far less than 1/4 inch. In Iowa, it is 8 feet straight down. They could take 1 square mile of Iowa and put it in Angola, and they'd put a huge fence around it and make it into a national park. And that black land extends all the way down, even through Texas. You can go across black land between here and Dallas that washed down there in the great floods that built the Mississippi River Delta. So I think of our bounteous resources, a nation that was called a sleeping giant by Yamamoto, a nation that was billed by FDR as the arsenal of democracy, a nation that geared up so that even people like General Motors were making tanks, and people like Alice Chalmers were making rifles, and that sent our 8 million men to war during World War II, when America ended up after that war with all the marbles. The true superpower, standing atop all other nations, with the largest standing army in the world, the richest nation that had ever been, and as never before and never since, a nation united under God, filled with a great sense of national purpose and patriotism. What has happened to our beloved country? Is it too late to get it back? I'll tell you this, if it weren't for the United States of America, I could not be doing what I do. The work of God could never have existed in Yugoslavia, in Iraq, in Iran, or anywhere else over there, in any other country you want to mention, including Great Britain, where you have nationalized communication media. It could only have started here, could only have been nurtured here, could only have grown to the proportions it has here in the United States of America. I think it's befitting that on the 4th of July, we think a little bit about our roots, about what we enjoy and oftentimes take so much for granted, And I was very glad. I had nothing to do with the choice of songs. Thank you very much for choosing those songs to begin our services today. I thought it was very appropriate, and I especially enjoyed singing the second verse of the Star-Spangled Banner. Again, thank you all very much for being here today, and I hope that you will all get a chance to say hello to my charming sister Dottie, whom I love with all my heart and being, and Vern, who is my closest brother now, my brother-in-law in the flesh that I have known for all these many years. I was a young teenage boy when he walked down that aisle and married my sis back in the early 40s before he went to Quantico and became a lieutenant in the Marine Corps. And he was wearing those bright blue Marine dress uniform, you know. Boy, I'll tell you what, was he a handsome man? He still is. You'll find out. He's still a handsome man. I hope you'll all get a chance to meet them. God bless you and God bless America.